Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Two kids from affluent Southern California families proved two important things in the mid-1970s. One we already knew, but had to be reminded of, and the other would shock a nation and change the American intelligence community forever. Let's take the easy one first. Christopher Boyce and Andrew Dalton Lee, barely out of their teens, proved that having everything you want growing up doesn't make growing up easier. Nor does it make you smarter or destined for success. It certainly doesn't make you prudent. Still, from their privileged start, Boyce and Lee went on to prove, maybe without really meaning to, that the American military-industrial complex was as secure as Great Aunt Minnie's purse. They revealed that a lot of America's deepest military secrets, the ones that were supposed to safeguard us from attack from other equally powerful nations, were regularly placed in a veritable sieve, an open invitation to idiots and ideologues to pilfer and offer for sale to somebody else's country. The young men, who were immortalized as the Falcon and the Snowman by a 1985 film of the same name, eventually shared classified documents that detailed how U.S. spy satellites operated and some of what they found. Those satellites were built by TRW, a defense contractor based in Southern California. Boyce and Lee shared the plans, as well as communication codebooks and CIA secrets, with the KGB via the Soviet Union's Mexico City embassy. The pair's treason lasted for 2 years as they naively played at being spies, unaware of or uncaring about the potential damage they were doing to the delicate balance of who would win the Cold War. Ultimately, Boyce and Lee would be caught because they were dumb and careless and in way, way over their heads, but not before they had at least theoretically compromised the rest of us. Did they sell anything important? Yes. Did it change anything? The U.S. noticed that the Soviet Union changed the way it transmitted much of what these satellites could detect, though it's difficult to say if that was a direct result of what the pair shared. Did they make loads of cash? In total, they made about $77,000, a pittance in spy dollars. Boyce, who was the brains of the operation, only made about $20,000. Why did they do it? Well, one had a conscience, the other had a drug habit. How'd they do it? Christopher Boyce explained that to the Bulletin newspaper in Bend, Oregon in 2013.
You know, I was brought up in a very conservative family. My father was an FBI agent, and I played football, went to Catholic school and all that. But then I grew up in an age of, you know, the assassinations of the Vietnam War and Nixon's impeachment and the race riots. And as I was growing up as a young fellow, though, it just, my experience of the federal government was that it got worse and worse. Yeah. I saw no improvement in the United States government. And I thought that it had abandoned all those things that I had been taught to love, you know, as a child.
It was in this sheltered, conservative world where Christopher Boyce would learn to think deep thoughts, question the morality of the American way of life, rebel against his father, master falconry, and wonder what to do with his life. And where Dalton Lee would learn that he had no patience for school, though he was good at woodworking, but excellent at selling drugs.
Love,
Christopher Boyce was the oldest of 9 children, the son of a security chief for an aircraft manufacturer and a stay-at-home mom. His father, Charles, had worked for the Federal Bureau of Investigations for a bit before heading to the private sector. Christopher Boyce was tall, good-looking, popular and athletic, bright and curious. It's been reported his IQ is a genius level 140. A risk-taker, he loved the outdoors and hated the usurpation of the Golden Hills of California by real estate developers bent on ripping away its beauty. Dalton Lee was the adopted son of a prominent doctor, wealthier than his friend Chris. A year older than Boyce, the two had grown up together. They went to the same public high school, both loved birds, and both learned how to control falcons on the hunt. Lee topped out at 5'2". He had bad acne and, while plenty smart, he didn't care much about school, succeeding only in woodshop. When he told his counselors he thought he might make a good carpenter, he was told that boys from Rancho Palos Verdes do not aspire to menial labor. Like a lot of teenagers, Lee found life pretty shitty. Girls weren't interested in him, and his overt competitiveness was considered boorish. He could, however, furnish those around him with free weed and the occasional hit of cocaine. That included Boyce, who genuinely liked Lee. They spent a lot of time together talking about life. Doing drugs was secondary, just a little fun on the side. But a lot of Lee's new friends were only there for the drugs he always seemed to have. Even the girls hung around, sometimes exchanging sex with him for drugs. He found dealing to be easy work, easy money, and an easy choice when he thought about a career. Boyce was not so sure what he wanted to do. He slipped in and out of 3 different colleges, unsure of the direction he wanted to go. His father, alarmed by his eldest child's aimlessness, contacted friends from his FBI days, and that got Christopher an interview at defense contractor TRW as a sort of stopgap measure while the boy figured out his life. For $140 a week, the upstanding 21-year-old was a polite kid and a quick learner, and for reasons still unclear, was thrown in the deep end as a general clerk in the company's classified material control. As such, Boyce signed the requisite pledge to not tell anyone about anything he saw there. He had not asked for this assignment. He was just looking to fill his time, make his father happy, and make a little money. He hadn't told anyone at TRW that he personally thought the United States was wrong about most things when it came to engaging on the international stage. Like almost everyone his age in 1974, he loathed the Vietnam War, deeming it senseless, wasteful, and fundamentally wrong. Don't get him started on Cambodia or Chile, where he thought the U.S. was illegally intervening, manipulating other people's governments, and generally inserting themselves in every arena, disrupting lives, and overthrowing regimes. On his first day of work,
part of my original briefing for the clearances was that we were not going to live up to the executive agreement we'd signed with Australia to share the information from our joint surveillance operations. And to me, this was just, from my own personal experience, another brick in the wall of what was wrong with the government.
Still, into the world of classified material control he went. Now, this intel he had access to was really sensitive stuff kept in something the folks at TRW called the Black Vault, a room that required you to get clearances from the CIA, FBI, and NSA. To get access, Boyce, who had no criminal record, sailed through his background checks and, soon enough, could see what TRW's satellites were doing at the behest of American intelligence and read what the CIA was sending back to headquarters. Boyce would later say that background check was kind of a joke.
To my knowledge, they never interviewed a single friend, a single peer, during the entire background investigations. Had they done so, the investigators would have interviewed a room full of disillusioned long hairs, counterculture falconers, druggy surfers, several wounded paranoid vets, pot-smoking anti-establishment types, beaten malcontents generally, many of whom were in trouble. Had the investigators asked any of those friends what I thought of the U.S. government, and in particular the CIA, I would never have gotten the job. Had they asked, they would have learned that I had first begun smoking pot at 16, that I had experimented with a variety of other drugs, along with most everyone else I knew in my age group. Had they asked, they would have learned that one of my closest friends and later partner in espionage was Dalton Lee, whose records on drug charges and probation violations was, by age 22, quite extraordinary. Had Mr. Carr even bothered to question his own sons, my high school classmates, they could have easily told him far more than the government's entire background investigation did.
You feeling safe yet? Anyway, about those satellites, they carried cameras that could find, as Robert Lindsay explained in his book, The Falcon and the Snowman, quote, missile bases, airfields, submarine pens, harbors, and other defense installations from 100 miles or more in space with such clarity that they could pinpoint a single man walking alone in a vast desert, end quote. In other words, the CIA was doing what the CIA does. The Black Vault was serious spy stuff. It was also party central, where the young people working there flirted a lot, drank on the job, they even made daiquiris in the shredder, and grew marijuana on their desks. There were drunken afternoons when people shared their life stories. One guy in the vault was a Vietnam vet who used to brag about his exploits while serving the country, which often involved killing for fun and raping for pleasure. All the while, Boyce drank and smoked on the job and covered his ass with politeness to superiors and efficient work. He had also been reading all of the telex messages about two intelligence gathering projects, Rhyolite and Argus, which were responsible for identifying, monitoring, and photographing those Soviet and Chinese missile launch sites. He knew this was information that should be sent on to Australia's capital of Canberra, but wouldn't be. Then, one day, a message click-clacked over the teletype machines. Boyce read that the CIA was at work in Australia, infiltrating unions and trying to dismantle the duly democratically elected government there. The CIA, and apparently the United States, also didn't much like Australia's Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, a reformist and socially progressive politician who was looking into what was going on at Pine Gap, the relay station for American intelligence satellite communication. And what would become a constitutional crisis for Australia, Whitlam was dismissed by the country's Governor General, Sir John Kerr, at the behest of the CIA. When he was replaced by the much preferred Malcolm Fraser, the Aussies were still kept in the dark about what the US knew. Australia is one of this country's allies, Boyce told Lee one night while sharing a doobie.
My government was deceiving an ally. Been an ally for two world wars, an English-speaking parliamentary democracy. I thought it was indicative to what my country had sunk to.
Something had to be done. And apparently, Boyce decided he was just the person to do it.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
While Chris Boyce was getting schooled in the ways of the real world, Dalton Lee was getting schooled in American jurisprudence. He'd been busted for selling marijuana to a high schooler and was in and out of court trying to navigate the system. His wealthy parents helped with his legal representation, which, by the way, was no means ineffective. And Lee was able to keep his burgeoning dope business on a steady path toward real success. At a party one night, Boyce and Lee were doing cocaine when Boyce brought up his serious misgivings about an arms race being conducted by robots in the sky. Lee was on another tack, explaining he wasn't going to serve time for a victimless crime. They bemoaned their lots in life. The two young men met the next weekend under similar partying circumstances, but by then, Boyce had decided to pitch a business proposition to Lee. He explained how he would copy some of the material he knew was damaging, and Lee would travel to Mexico City to sell it to the Soviets. Money was always a good incentive when talking to Dalton Lee, and Boyce was talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. Shortly thereafter, Lee was busted in a Redondo Beach apartment with enough heroin, cocaine, marijuana, LSD, and amphetamines to net him a serious dealing charge. Always a charismatic guy and a fast talker, Lee and his fancy lawyers worked the justice system as best they could, with Lee conning cops, parole officers, judges, and his parents. For a guy with a growing criminal record, he had done very little time to show for it. An example of this. In the Redondo Beach case, his bail was originally set at $15,000. By the time he'd have to pay it, he'd made his apologies and promises to the courts and the cops, and his bail was lowered to $500. Actually, what he had done was promise the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department he'd be a snitch for them, but he couldn't in good conscience follow through. He hemmed and he hawed, all while engaging in a heroin habit that by now was a $300-a-week habit, one that would dog him despite his best efforts to break free. When Boyce offered him the unique work partnership, he was ready to find some solid work that got him out of this country. Mexico was a good place to hide, and his childhood friend had just thrown him a pretty attractive lifeline. Boyce worked out the details. He gave a card and a note to Lee to take to the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. The note read, quote, "This is a computer card from the NSA crypto system. If you want to do business, please advise the courier," end quote. Lee got on an airplane in early April 1975, on the same day that cops came looking for him at his childhood home. His parents told the cops that he'd gone to live in Mexico. Lee walked into the embassy, told the receptionist what he wanted to do, and was greeted by an official of the Soviet government. That official immediately asked who Lee's friend was. He said his friend would remain anonymous, but he believed in the future of socialism. "And by the way," he said, "I'm on the run from a trumped-up drug charge." Together, Lee and his unnamed friend would deliver American defense secrets for some cold, hard American cash. You can imagine what the Soviet embassy rep, who was really KGB, must have made of Dalton Lee. But they drank vodka and talked, with Vasily Okana leaving the room at times to consult with others, returning to talk more about the satellites that the young men were familiar with, and, ultimately, making a deal to do more business. Lee left with $250 and instructions to never return to the embassy. Eventually, he was given a code name, Lewis, and told how to contact the KGB by using a large strip of surgical tape to place an X on a certain light pole in one of the city's public squares. The two men even exchanged secret passwords. A delighted Lee called Boyce on a payphone, and they used aliases to greet one another, like they imagined they should, given all the TV they had watched. Lee then went back to his hotel room and wrote sweet letters to his family, telling his brother to stay in school because, quote, "this organized crime shit is expensive when you add up the Alka-Seltzer," end quote. He toured Mexico and made plans to return to L.A. in a quick turnaround to pick up some more goods from Boyce. So began an almost two-year game of Boyce carrying top-secret documents, technical drawings, codes, and plans out of the TRW building to be copied, then later photographed by either Boyce or Lee, then returned to the contractor's home base via satchel or potted plant, and then back to the Black Vault. That way, no one was the wiser. Then Lee would contact O'Connor and make the switch for money. It was never a lot of money, and Lee never gave Boyce his 50% share of the payout. Always looking for fresh angles, Lee was using as much cash as he could reasonably keep to himself to hopefully gain leverage with the Mexican mafia so he could start running heroin and coke back to the States. Meanwhile, he supplemented his daily drug rations with almost constant alcohol, while he bought the favors of Mexico City's finest sex workers. His legal troubles in the U.S. had not subsided. Still, he traveled freely. Remember, this all took place before 2001, when all travel became suddenly and sharply prescribed and all travelers scrutinized, x-rayed, and made to take their shoes off before boarding. It was also before computers could ID those who had warrants out on them. Pretty much all Lee had to do was pay the airfare and step on and off the plane without incident, and he did it often, staying a long while in the US when he grew tired of Mexico. Sometimes he'd go to the trouble of using different names, like the identities of long-deceased infants who had birth dates on record with the government. To the Soviets, he remained just Louis, a rather quirky, flighty, self-serving little man who had no idea what he was really doing. Once, he even suggested to the Soviets that they move some coke from Peru to the US in diplomatic pouches for him. That went over well. Lee continued to be caught with illicit substances while home, and all too frequently, he would wiggle free, making promises to show up for court dates, which he steadfastly refused to honor. Boyce was ostensibly humming along, proving his worth to his employers who were giving him more and more duties deeper and deeper into the secret workings of U.S. intelligence. In an interview with the Australian version of 60 Minutes in a segment titled A Spy's Story, Boyce admitted it was all kind of cool.
21 years old, it's quite a thrill, yes. It's high adventure. A little hard on your adrenaline gland, but it's very exciting. Never knew when they were coming to get you. It tainted everything else in your life.
Soon, though, every time Lee met with a Soviet contact, he was badgered about disclosing the name of his partner and the name of the firm he worked for. The Soviets were, they insisted, anxious to meet him. The agreement had always been that Lee would not disclose Boyce's identity. Back in Southern California, Christopher Boyce had fallen in love and was worried now more than ever about where this all would end. He traveled around a bit on the money Lee was handing over and was impressing his bosses, who even offered him two different jobs in the CIA, one of those in Australia of all places, but he declined. Things were getting very real. Once, the NSA showed up to inspect the Black Vault to assure themselves it was secure. Boyce believed the jig was up. Nope. The NSA were good with how things were working down there. Meanwhile, Lee was being pestered by the KGB to obtain code room transmission frequencies for the satellites. Lee assured him those codes were coming, despite the fact that Boyce had no such access, and he had told Lee that. The drug dealer spy was becoming more of a loose cannon than ever. While drinking heavily with the Russians, he divulged Chris's name. He'd also shown up at the embassy to do business when he had expressly been told not to. Some of his mistakes led to some scary moments, like when the KGB hustled him out of the embassy in the middle of the night and into a car driven by men who didn't speak English, dragged him through Mexico City, and dumped him in the middle of nowhere. Lee, as a result, was a physical wreck. Boyce, on the other hand, was taking his falcon out to the wild and wonderful places he loved to watch him soar, hunt, and devour his prey, mesmerized by the bird's grace and competency, his wholehearted embrace of freedom, and his sheer dominance over the terrain below. Concerned about what was happening in Mexico City, Boyce made a trip there to meet the people with whom Lee had been dealing. While there, Lee's latest Soviet contact, a guy named Boris, wondered if Boyce might try to finish college and then apply for a CIA position so he might provide even better information to them. He asked how much money Boyce would need to finish school. They all agreed that was a good plan. Then, because the contact, Lee, and Boyce were all dead drunk while this was discussed, they returned home, never to speak of it again. Back in the States, Lee's lawyers were stalling what appeared to be his eventual incarceration for drug-related crimes. They were having him looked at by psychiatrists and psychologists to give him some path toward treatment that didn't involve jail. Lee kept postponing appointments, and his lawyers kept getting continuances. While Lee's parents had no idea about his espionage work, they stood by him steadfastly during his drug tribulations. They gave him every opportunity to get sober and always paid for his first-rate defense. Lee, ever the dealmaker, convinced himself that one more big spy score would be the ticket, that if he could make enough in one big swoop, he could buy another life in Costa Rica, where he was convinced the Soviets would buy him a house. He saw a chance when Boyce mentioned something called perimeter. At least I think that's how it's pronounced. It's spelled like pyramid, but with an ER at the end. Anyway, the project was for the company to build a satellite that would facilitate direct CIA communication. It had a unique design that looked like an open umbrella. Boyce was okay with shopping that info to the Soviets, but he was tired or scared now of how Lee was behaving. For the briefest interval, he considered that the only way out of this was to kill Lee. The idea passed, but he told his biographer that the impulse was real. Then the world shifted for Boyce and Lee. Lee, never a patient man, decided he'd get the attention of Okana, that Russian contact who'd been with him from the beginning, not by their usual methods, but by tossing a note attached to a rock over the gates into the Soviet embassy. Mexican police had been watching and quickly gathered him up. He said he'd dropped a cigarette. They disagreed, and it got very hot, very fast. Strangely enough, exiting the embassy just then was an American embassy staffer. Lee complained to her that he was an American citizen, so she agreed to have someone meet him at the police station where he was being taken. There, he was told to empty his pockets, and what do you know? Out came a tiny roll of film. Plain to see were the little bitty words, "Top Secret," across one of the frames. Lee told them he was a photographer for an ad agency and this was not important stuff. The Americans were told to return in an hour while the Mexican officials developed the film. Instead, the Mexicans charged him with murder. Seems that a postcard he also had on him was a picture of the exact spot where a Mexican police officer had recently been gunned down. Lee was then stripped, beaten severely, dunked in a toilet, blindfolded, and handcuffed, and left in a cell. During the interrogation, Lee said he was not a murderer, just a guy selling secrets to the Soviets. The FBI, brought in to assist the detained American, were very interested in that part of this poor doofus's story. Would the Mexicans please return him? The Mexican authorities gave Lee a choice. He could be handed over to the Russians or to the Americans. They would do as he asked, as long as he wasn't in their country anymore. Driven north for days, Lee was dropped off at the border crossing in Laredo, Texas. Waiting for him were a covey of cops from all kinds of agencies.
Don't miss Scarpetta, a propulsive new crime thriller starring Academy Award winner Nicole Kidman, Academy Award winner Jamie Lee Curtis, Emmy winner Bobby Cannavale, with Emmy nominee Simon Baker and Academy Award winner Ariana DeBose. Scarpetta follows Dr. Kay Scarpetta, Nicole Kidman, a brilliant and no-nonsense chief medical examiner, as she investigates a haunting murder that strangely parallels her first major case from decades earlier. Is the case that made her the case that breaks her? Based on the best-selling crime novels by Patricia Cornwell, Scarpetta is both a crime thriller and messy family drama that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Get ready to hunt a serial killer in the satisfying series with terrifying twists and an ending you won't see coming. Watch all episodes of Scarpetta now, only on Prime Video.
Six days after Dalton Lee's arrest, the Black Vault was shut down. Regis Carr, TRW's Director of Security for Special Programs, told the FBI that, quote, Christopher Boyce had access to the entire inner workings of the intelligence community, with daily access to intelligence communications, documents, and hardware. He's operated as a courier within the plant and outside, operated a secure voice communication system, and an encrypted TWX network online with the government contractors and overseas stations, and he talked to the CIA directly by TWX. End quote. On January 7th, Christopher Boyce was arrested and within days confessed to it all.
I knew from the beginning that I would eventually be caught. There was no escape from it. After all, I'm an amateur, 21 years old, and the Central Intelligence Agency had been in business a lot longer than I had. And to tell you the truth, I didn't think it would go on longer for a month or two. I was amazed that it went on for 2 years.
Soon, though, self-preservation kicked in. Boyce changed his mind. He said it was all Lee's idea. His attorneys argued that none of what they gave the Soviets was even that useful. Boyce was tried first. He could be a martyr to his political leanings and his heartfelt belief that America was in danger of losing her soul, or he could lie to pretend it was all a horrible misunderstanding. You're probably thinking the upstanding hardline ideologue took the martyr route. Nope. He lied like a dog, though no one seemed to be buying his story that this was all Lee's idea and that Lee was blackmailing him, thus forcing him to hand over classified documents. It took a mere 3.5 hours of deliberation to convict him on all 8 counts of espionage and conspiracy to commit espionage. Dalton Lee's attorneys told his jury that he and Christopher Boyce worked for the CIA and they knowingly worked to supply the Soviet Union with bad intel. And then the CIA cut them loose. Pity this poor outright capitalist. This was apparently a better story because the jury worried on it for a while. One juror, a woman who said she knew the CIA were shifty, held out for 6 days. Then she changed her mind. Lee was convicted on 8 counts, including espionage and conspiracy to commit espionage, as well as unauthorized possession of secret government material. The next day, the juror and Lee's attorneys informed the judge that she really still had reasonable doubt, that the jury had known of Boyce's conviction, which they were not to have been told, and that they failed to follow the judge's explicit instructions. U.S. Federal Judge Robert Keeler interviewed every member of the jury and decided there were no grounds for a new trial. Boyce got 40 years in prison. Lee got life. The difference may have been that Lee had proved to not exactly be the model citizen his lawyers had insisted he was, what with his criminal record reaching around the block. Boyce, meanwhile, had been a pretty good guy before all of this. It's fair to say Christopher Boyce didn't retain his good guy image after his incarceration. He escaped from his California prison in 1980, later saying he had used techniques he'd gathered when the prison showed the movie Escape from Alcatraz to the inmates. Many assumed that story was a lie and that he actually must have gotten help from his Soviet friends. Boyce later corrected the record there.
I did it with the help of the incompetency of the United States Bureau of Prisons. I had no outside help.
He got as far as Beaver, Washington, before he was recaptured only 2 weeks shy of obtaining his pilot's license. During his 19 months on the lam, he committed 17 nonviolent bank robberies to support himself. He told the Bend Bulletin, that misjudgment still dogs him.
All the things I've done in my life, that's what I most regret. You know, that made people afraid. You know, that affected people for a long, long time. You know, I never wanted to leave the country. I wanted to stay here. I didn't want to live anywhere else, even as I was a fugitive. And I love it here.
25 years were added on to his 40-year sentence, despite his explanation that he'd only escaped to save his own life. In 1985, Boyce testified before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence as it probed ways to stop future espionage. He was emphatic.
There is nothing potential about the KGB. That state apparatus not only threatens every open society, but it crushes open societies. That is the distinction that I could not see at a rebellious 21. And it is a distinction that which Americans must see.
Because of threats to his life while in some prisons, he was moved around the prison system to land at the Minnesota State Prison, where he was determined to be safe. While there, he wrote more than a dozen opinion pieces for the Minneapolis Star Tribune and earned a college degree. In one piece, he seemed to be remorseful about what he'd done, though it was couched in terms of how he had treated his father. Quote, "Espionage was a cruel wound to inflict on a father who loved me," end quote. He also noted when the Cold War was over, when the Berlin Wall fell, that he was, quote, "drowning in the realization that I chose the wrong path," end quote. Still, he was not sorry as much as he was aware that he hadn't changed anything. When asked by the Australian reporter if he had jeopardized the lives of every American man, woman, and child by his actions, he responded, quote, "they are already in jeopardy," end quote. And he added,
"it seemed to me my government had betrayed me long before I ever betrayed them."
Not all of his opinions were warmly received. When he wrote about the shortcomings of the prison system, he got himself moved to the so-called Supermax prison in Colorado, where he served alongside Oklahoma bomber Timothy McVeigh and Unabomber Ted Kaczynski. Boyce also decried the way prison cut its inmates off from nature. He wrote that he had not seen a tree in over a decade, and that made a hard life almost unbearable. Dalton Lee was released in 1998, upon the recommendation of the judge who initially sentenced him. For a brief time, he worked as an assistant to Sean Penn, the actor who played him in the 1985 film about his exploits. Here's a snippet.
"I am a tourist. I am a businessman.
So you're a spy. Do you have some identification?
I had no idea the extent of the lie, the level of deception.
Who did you receive your instructions from?
You want to be partners? I'm offering you a partnership."
For the past 20-plus years, Lee has laid low. It seems he's still alive. He turned 72 this year. But the last time I see his name in archive newspapers was 2012, when obituaries ran for the judge who had overseen his trial. Boyce was released on parole in September 2002 at age 50. He had served 25 years. Since his release, he's written books, given speeches, and talked at length with reporters. He now lives in Oregon, is married to the woman who helped with his and Lee's early release, and, yes, still has falcons. He said he had been naive, that while his nation had let him down, he was never a communist. He told CNN that he was probably a guy who was destined to tilt at windmills.
That doesn't justify what I did, but I used it as an excuse to launch a one-man war, as I saw it, on Central Intelligence. And, of course, that was insane. That was crazy.
The CIA has called what Boyce and Lee did the most damaging act of espionage in decades. But only the Soviets know what was given them. Everyone, including them, remains mum. To research this story, journalist Amy Wilson read The Falcon and the Snowman by Robert Lindsay, 1979, The Flight of the Falcon by Robert Lindsay, 1983, American Sons, The Untold Story of the Falcon and the Snowman by Christopher Boyce, Kate Boyce, and Vince Font, 2018. She also watched Christopher Boyce's 1985 testimony before the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations concerning the U.S. Government Personnel Security Program and 60 Minutes Australia, A Spy's Story, with journalist Ray Martin, 1982. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.